This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 9/11 and Osama bin Laden made us all aware of radical Islam and an Islamist movement that rejects modernity, secularism in the West, and seeks a return to simpler times. Recently, though, scholar and writer Francis Fukuyama suggested that conventional interpretation on radical Islam be turned on its head. He suggested that bin Laden and his followers may well be inadvertent modernizers. In an article titled Destructive Creation that appeared in Commentary magazine, Fukuyama and co-author Nadav Samin argue that bin Ladenism owes as much to fascism and communism as it does to Islamic tradition, that much of the turmoil in the Arab world today is not an anomaly, but something other cultures have also gone through, the West in particular, and that, though painful, this might be a necessary part of an evolution toward a modern liberal democratic society. Later in this program, we'll talk about two portraits being added today to a place of honor in the United States Senate, and we'll read from your letters. But first, Francis Fukuyama joins us. If you have questions about the forces at work in the Islamic world today or his use of Western political history as an analogy, give us a call. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. In addition to Destructive Creation, Francis Fukuyama is also the author of The End of History, Trust, The Great Disruption, and Our Post-Human Future. He's a professor of international political economy at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies here in Washington, and he joins us now in Studio 3A. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
The subtitle of your article is the question, Can Any Good Come of Radical Islam? It's a pretty provocative question. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Well, I started from the question of whether this phenomenon that we are so intensely aware of, radical Islamism, is best thought of as a traditional or a modern phenomenon. Most people think of it as some kind of a cultural expression that comes out of some ancient pattern in Islamic history. And that's why it's frequently referred to as some form of Islamic fundamentalism.
And bin Laden himself harkens back to the 14th century.
That's right. But on the other hand, I think that there are a number of reasons for thinking that this is actually not as unfamiliar a phenomenon as all that. And in certain respects, it's quite modern. If you look at the intellectual history of bin Ladenism's particular form. And by the way, it's important to get the terminology straight. The term of art that's been coined is Islamism, mm-hmm. to distinguish it from Islam, the religion. Islamism is the radical doctrine that has been enunciated by bin Laden. And if you look back at the history of this doctrine, it can be traced back to people like Hassan al-Banna, who was the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, an organization that got started. He was a school teacher in Egypt in the 1920s. And if you look at the history of that whole movement, it is actually very similar to a lot of European radical political movements at the time, particularly fascism. In fact, the Muslim Brotherhood had contact with the German and Italian fascists. They organized youth wings. They imported all sorts of Western terms into their vocabulary, like revolution, state, class struggle. And all of these are not native to Islam, the religion. I think these are really terms that come out of the process of modernization, and they represent, in a way, sociologically, the same forces that led to fascism and other radical forms of politics in the early 20th century in Europe.
Does that mean that you think of bin Ladenism as a form of totalitarianism?
Well, I think it's very similar to that. Totalitarianism means the complete subordination of society to politics in a certain sense. Now, this is a kind of papo-Caesarism. I mean, it's a combination of religion and politics, but it certainly seeks to abolish any kind of sphere of private life. And so in that sense, I think it is quite similar to the totalitarian ideologies that existed in Europe. But it's, fascism itself was a funny syncretic mixture of old, German symbols with modern political ideas and modern technology. And I think in very similar ways, Islamism, radical Islamism, is a similar technologically based mixture of traditional religious themes, but also modern organizational techniques and other modern concepts. And some of it is aimed as much at traditional Islam and the practice of traditional Islam as it is at the modern West.
And we'll get to that in a moment, but I wanted to point out that you also say that the Nazi movement, in its appeal to Arianism, also had at least a superficial appeal to a romanticized past.
Oh, sure, that's the case. The question is this some kind of an authentic, or is this a kind of made-up nostalgia for the past? And I think most scholars of fascism would say that they're actually not really trying to set the clock back. It's a completely imaginary past that these extreme nationalists are trying to create. And in a sense, the kind of pure Islamic community is also one that really never existed historically in the case of bin Ladenism.
Communism, where does that come into this equation?
Well, there's a great deal of talk about class struggle and the kind of universalizing tendencies that I think are inherent in communism that are also similar in this movement. But again, it is a totalitarian ideology that seeks to, you know, provide a comprehensive explanation for, you know, for all political phenomena. And I think the organizational techniques are very similar, very centralized and built around doctrine with very tight internal organization.
Now, how does then Osama bin Laden, al-Qaeda, how do they become even inadvertent modernizers?
Well, first of all, let me say some things at the outset. This is not anyone's preferred way of modernizing. I think that just like no one would have wanted to reproduce Germany's 20th century history, having to go through war, revolution, Nazism, and so forth to get to the Federal Republic after 1949. So clearly there are easier ways of getting there. But that being said, sometimes these radical political movements, because they kick the legs out of traditional society and certain traditional practices, inadvertently serve the aims of modernization. And I think that this may be happening in the Middle East, because there are many traditions, you know, there's a whole corpus of traditional Islamic law, for example, that mandates, for example, that if you set up a waqf, a charitable foundation, you basically can't change the charter. And so, you know, many of these legal institutions act as I think, fairly powerful brakes against economic change and innovation and the like. And to the extent that this is a doctrine that is aimed at many of these at the corpus of traditional Islam as much as at the West, I think that in the long run, assuming that it is defeated, which I actually am quite confident it will be over time, then it may clear out some of that underbrush and then permit, you know, a different, somewhat more liberal form of politics to arise in Muslim countries.
And the example you cite is the example of Osama bin Laden's issuance of his famous fatwa. And you point out that Osama bin Laden within the Islamic world has no credentials to issue.
Well, that's right. There's a hierarchy of Muslim clerics that have the authority to issue fatwas. His fatwa was actually denounced by many people in that traditional hierarchy, because in fact he's just a son of a rich businessman from Saudi Arabia and really does not have the kind of legal jurisprudential standing to issue that kind of declaration. So it's a little bit like Lenin speaking on behalf of the Russian Orthodox Church or Hitler speaking on behalf of the Catholic Church.
Which those of us who are more familiar with that context would say is laughably absurd. But at the same time, you point out, undermines by the simple act of its issuance, undermines the legitimate authorities.
That's right. That's right. And to the extent that those legitimate authorities were actually part of what served as a brake on the overall modernization of much of the Muslim world, that may be something that in the long run will, you know, it may act like a solvent that will cause people to dispute authority in a broader way.
Our guest is Francis Fukuyama. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And our first caller is Saeed, who joins us on the line from Rochester Hills, Michigan.
Good afternoon, Mr. Conan. Good afternoon, Dr. Fukuyama. It's a pleasure.
Good afternoon.
After reading your article and after listening to your discussion, sir, I'd like to thank you for making the distinction between radical Islam and mainstream Islam in this day and age. That's nothing to be taken for granted. But I was wondering regarding your examination of the genesis of radical Islam. You cite Hassan al-Banna and Sayyid Qutb, two figures in the Muslim Brotherhood movement. It seems as though you have made the parallels of radical Islam to perhaps the most odious eras of Western European history, which is fascism and communism, whereas one might be able to argue and perhaps get a better understanding of the pathology of radical Islam if one looked at the U.S. Revolution and the French Revolution, because I think that Hassan al-Banna and Sayyid Qutb and what they were up against in Egypt, what they were seeing as the deterioration of Egyptian society, what they saw as the evils of colonialism, it seemed as though the revolt that both Banna and Qutb took was more on the lines of what you saw in 18th century France, 18th century United States, as opposed to necessarily citing Lenin or Mussolini, for example. I'd like to see what your comment would be on that.
Well, I think that their doctrine was more radical than that, because it really, I think, did contain the seeds in it of what we would recognize as modern totalitarianism. There was an earlier period, I think, in the history of many Muslim countries in which the model was more the liberal West, and you had these, I wouldn't call them good Democrats by any means, but you had these more Western-oriented modernizers like Reza Shah in Iran, or, of course, Ataturk in Turkey, that were willing to accept more elements of if not a democratic West, at least a liberal West. And I think that that was really the generation before the rise of this particular, you know, brand of Islamic radicalism.
But you see, in the case of Reza Shah, Dr. Fukuyama, I mean, we had a democratization in Iran in the 50s with Mossadegh, who was then removed because his policies, democratic that they were not palpable to the West.
Well, that's right. I think that it is the case that these radical movements have very complex roots. A lot of it, I think, is rooted in the kinds of social change that are common to all modernizing societies. So that, for example, European fascism, I think, was rooted in this shift in a very rapid period in continental Europe from a peasant agricultural society to a urbanized industrial one. And although the industrialization hasn't been taking place, in many Middle Eastern countries you have that same shift from countryside, from villager or tribesman into a modern urban setting, which is very alienating. And you also have short-term political grievances. You have economic stagnation. You have the lack of any meaningful kind of political participation. You certainly have foreign policy grievances, external intervention, colonialism. All of these factors, I think, are contributing factors to getting these movements started in the first place and then to radicalizing them.
I agree with you. I think, in fact, because of that, we can see that the hope and the future for these Muslim countries is perhaps better rooted in a reformation that came after or succeeded the initial turmoil of democratization in the United States and in France. And although I certainly, as a Muslim, do not subscribe to radical Islam, I would like to see that any kind of reform movement is not necessarily considered pernicious because of the dangers of there being fascism and communism coming into place, because I think that is what's driving our maintenance of some totalitarian regimes in Muslim countries right now, for example, in Egypt and Saudi Arabia, because of this fear that there's going to be the fascicization or the communization of these Islamic countries when those aren't the only alternatives available. And I thank you.
Saeed, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it. We're talking with scholar, thinker, and author Francis Fukuyama about the idea of radical Islam as a perhaps inadvertent modernizing force, and we'll come back after a short break and take more of your calls. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today with scholar and writer Francis Fukuyama about the idea of radical Islam as a modernizing force, though not by intent. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And I wanted to ask you, you were talking just before the break about a lot of the demographic factors in many Muslim countries, of many people moving into urban areas from the countryside, something that previously took place in other cultures, and to which you draw analogies. And one of the things you write a lot about is a UN report that was issued last year, I guess.
That's right.
That was written not by Western critics, but by Arab critics.
That's right. It was a Arab Human Development Report written by the sponsored by the UN Development Program. It's a fascinating critique, a kind of internal critique of some of the problems in human development in Arab countries, and it, in a way, it points to the failure of economic modernization, the absence of political opportunity. The last caller mentioned these regimes like Egypt and Algeria that are dictatorships. I think that it's quite striking throughout the Arab world that although there you have some glimmerings in the Gulf of more democratic practices, that compared to the big waves of both economic reform and political opening that have occurred in the former communist world, in East Asia, in Latin America, that most of those trends have passed the Arab world by. And I think it's important to try to sort out the causes for that. It would be surprising if somehow religion didn't play a role in it. So again, as the last caller mentioned, it's the fear, I think, of radical Islamism coming to power that has acted as a brake. But I think we have to ask ourselves whether that's a permanent obstacle, or in fact whether this is a region that in some sense might not be ripe for reform. And I would say that there are some actually hopeful signs in the wind. Probably the most significant of them is what's going on in Iran right now. And I guess that's what makes me a little bit optimistic in the long run, that radical Islamism, in a certain sense, has been a complete failure as a ruling ideology. You've had two countries now where it's been put into practice. You have Iran and Afghanistan. We have seen what's happened after the liberation of Kabul from the Taliban. In Iran right now, there is basically a tremendous amount of political, social ferment. About 70% of the population is under the age of 30. In that age group, virtually nobody wants a continuation of this medieval clerical regime. And so I think, it is a country that is really ripe for a fair amount of very positive political change.
Let's go back to the phones. Our next caller is Jim, who's on the line with us from Denver.
Hello.
Hi.
I'd like to ask your guest to comment on, it seems to me that what's going on in the Arab world now with sort of violence in the name of religion looks a lot like what happened in Northern Europe at the time of the Reformation. And if he could just kind of comment on, does he see any parallels there, and if there's any lessons to be learned about how this finally settled down.
I think that there is a very important lesson, which is the danger of sectarian or religiously based politics. A lot of people make this assertion that in Islam there has been no separation of church and state, or that political power and religion tend to be united in certainly in the politics of these radical groups, and that's of course true. But that was also the case in Christian Europe at the end of the Middle Ages. Pretty much every prince set the sectarian, the confessional direction of his subjects. And after the Reformation, Europe went into 150 years of almost unremitting warfare between Protestants and Catholics, between different sects of Protestants. In Germany, something like 30% of the population of Central Europe was killed in the course of the 30 Years' War. And modern liberalism that tries to separate church and state was not something that Christianity or Christian civilization created spontaneously. It was the reaction to this period of sectarian warfare that led early liberals like Hobbes and Locke, and in a tradition that stretches ultimately to the American founding fathers, to say that religion really didn't have a place in politics, it needed to be put aside. And that, in a sense, is, I think, what the Muslim world is facing right now. You have religiously oriented politics that is very bloody. Samuel Huntington once referred to Islam's bloody borders, and I think, you know, it's the direct result of the mixture of religion and politics. And so the question is, can they go through the kind of political evolution that Europe did, but hopefully on a much more compressed time scale?
And less destructive arc as well.
Well, it's been destructive enough as it is, and hopefully it you know, will come without really apocalyptic violence.
Jim, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Here's an email question we got from Chris Mendoza. German fascism, he writes, was a highly nationalistic response to French and English domination and the threat of international communism. Why can't we understand bin Laden as representing Arab rejection of U.S. domination of the Middle East?
Well, as I said, I think that there are many causes of these kinds of political movements, and so certainly the ostensible, you know, political agenda that bin Laden has enunciated, opposition to American presence in Saudi Arabia and the
land of the two holy places,
right,
yes,
is one of the driving forces. The Palestinian issue is another one. But I think that there are a lot of people that are upset about American foreign policy. What you really need to explain is the particular virulence and the kind of nihilistic violence that this particular movement has led to. And I think that requires an explanation that goes a little bit beyond just the fact that they're mad about American imperialism, because there are plenty of people around the world that are mad about that don't engage in this kind of terrorism.
Our next caller is David, who's on the line with us from San Francisco.
Yes, indeed. I, from what I know about the economics of Moses and the Muslim world, and hypothetically, Christians, Jews, and Muslims are supposed to be obeying these laws. Moses felt that money was a creation of humans, and as such, it was not a living thing. And then, as such, a non-living thing cannot have children. So the concept, the Western concept of interest rates, usury, is considered an abomination to God. And in many ways, in the scientific world, it is as well, because it defies the laws of for every action, there's an equal reaction. In the world of economics, for every action, there's a separate but equal reaction plus interest. And so when you look at the economics of major corporations who essentially move about in the world taking, and never giving back the separate but equal, you know, obviously it doesn't get into a religious argument about whether or not there should be some cleanup of the wastes that are laid upon the world. So I wonder where this concept fits into your guest's scenario. We can certainly pretend that bin Laden did this, and then bin Laden has some kind of belief that retribution or some recompense should come to the Middle East from the Western world. But I think it's pretty clear that this is a larger picture that does not include limited only to whether or not Muslims, Christians, and Jews are of some disparate religion. They're all stemming from the original, and whether or not there's an authenticity to what they pretend to believe.
Well, the prohibition against usury or interest, which existed in the Christian tradition, the medieval Catholic tradition, just as in many branches of contemporary Islam, makes sense if you believe in a world of static resources where one person's gain is another person's loss. But I think one of the elements of the modern world is the discovery of modern technologically based capitalism, in which business investment actually leads to productivity and the generation of new wealth, in which case interest becomes an absolutely critical element of economic productivity. And so in the Christian West, there was a lot of doctrinal to-ing and fro-ing, and as people began to realize this in the early modern period, and then the separation, you know, clerics were put out of the business of setting prices and capping interest rates, and we get the modern economic world. And I think that something like this is bound to happen in the Islamic world as well, because a prohibition on interest makes no more sense there than it did in the Christian world. And that's one of those elements of modernization that I think is something that necessarily has to take place.
Well, as a follow-up, we're hearing lately, and this doesn't limit it to the Muslims, we're hearing that in North Korea that they're flooded with counterfeit currency, that the U.S. government has been flooding them with counterfeit currency. So when we look at this concept of whether or not any country in the entire world can have an authentic currency that is not going to be subject to the crimes of another nation, and then as such looted with impunity, and then once they try to defend themselves, they're attacked with the mighty force of, what are we getting into, 250,000 U.S. 18-year-olds that are going to go out there and kill for the oil companies? You know, this is not what America was supposed to be about. And then this concept of twisting religions, like you've just used this phrase about a static religion or a static economy that someone gets and someone loses. That's not the basis of economy. There's a fair exchange. Someone does a service for another person, and there's a separate but equal reaction. There's a give and take on both ends. But this idea of for cause and effect, the scientific aspect of it. The earth cannot just take billions of gallons of liquid out of the ground and turn them into gas and then pretend that there's not going to be health effects or global warming effects in the entire planet. These oil companies should be paying pollution costs. We should be taking these quarter million soldiers that we're sending over there, have them drop off on the French and Spanish coasts cleaning up these oil spills. We're enormously wasting America's manpower on an oil war when, in fact, we should be cleaning up the planet from what the oil companies have done.
Yeah, if you wanted to respond, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean,
it's an awful lot, isn't it?
Yeah, raised an awful lot of points. I would just like to say that, you know, living as close to this policy issue of Iraq as I do here in Washington, I think it's pretty safe to say that oil is not the secret issue that is driving this administration. I think that they're quite honestly worried about the possession of weapons of mass destruction by a fellow that's shown himself to be quite willing to take extraordinary risks. But that's a separate argument.
Weapons, right?
Well, some of them, David. Anyway, thanks very much for the call.
Bye.
Some of the stories you can hear later today from NPR News. Another Democrat has declared that he'll seek the right to challenge President Bush for the White House. NPR's Mara Liasson is covering Senator Joseph Lieberman's announcement today. And the U.S. may be offering North Korea an olive branch in the standoff over Pyongyang's right to develop nuclear weapons. NPR's Vicky O'Hara is covering the diplomacy surrounding that issue. She'll tell us about the possibility of energy aid for the North if it backs down. And you can hear both of those stories today on All Things Considered from NPR News. We are talking right now with Francis Fukuyama, who's a professor of international political economy at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C. After the next break, we're going to come back and also talk about two new portraits in a very special gallery in the United States Senate. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now let's go to Anesh, who joins us on the line from Berkeley, California.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is for Professor Fukuyama about his use of this dichotomy of modern versus traditional. I partly agree with some of his analysis that these radical Islamic movements are basically very modern movements, and you know it can be applied to militant Hinduism in India or even right-wing Christianity in the U.S. And the question is, then what is tradition? If these are all modern movements, what is tradition? Because the theoretical framework of modernization theories is that there is a tradition from which we are actually moving ahead. And we'll get to that idyllic space of, you know, where everything is really wonderful and happy.
Mm-hmm.
But in the social sciences, this analysis has been questioned a lot recently. And the modern character of these movements has been actually discussed for a long time, for the last 20 years. You know, Wallerstein and Balibar have discussed it already in their Race, Class, Nation book. So there's nothing new in that analysis. But what I'm questioning is this dichotomy of modern versus tradition. Then what is tradition if everything is modern?
Well, first of all, I don't think that everything is modern. I think that first of all, there's not a single thing as tradition. I think that one of the characteristics of tradition is that it's extremely diverse, and you know there are many cultural trends. And so for example, in the particular case that I've been discussing, particularly in the Sufi tradition, in many parts of particularly Central Asia, there's a great deal of saint worship that is, in a certain way, not, you know, that doesn't have a precedent in the Quran and in early Islam. And you could say that that, you know, is a product of the historical development of that region, you know, at a certain period, but it has become traditional. And when I say that this radical Islamism is aimed at tradition, it is aimed, for example, very much in Central Asia at Sufi saint worship, which I think these radicals believe is a kind of abomination. I mean, they regard it the way a lot of Protestants regarded the cult of Mary at the end of the Middle Ages. So, you know, there are a lot of ways of defining these terms, but I think there is a real struggle going on there between forms of religion that in a sense are more authentic in that they're just carried forward from the past, and new doctrines that someone sitting around thought up as a kind of ideology to explain the world at a certain point in our recent past.
Anesh, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And just to follow up on that, do you see any parallels, asks Randy from Detroit, any parallels between radical Islamism and the radical Christian fundamentalism that exists in the U.S.? That was one of the points Anesh was making as well.
Well, there's a parallel in that both of them are politicized forms of religion. I think that broadly speaking, the... Well, first of all, it depends on what you mean by radical Christians. There's a large evangelical movement. There are various forms of fundamentalism. I think most of those are, you know, have long ago made their peace with modern liberal democracy, the modern economy, you know, most elements of the modern world. They're, you know, issues that where they disagree with other people. But I think the disagreement tends to be much less... radical than in the case of the Islamists. Actually, one of the interesting neglected cultural revolutions that's going on in the world right now is the Protestantization of Latin America, which I think in actual numerical terms is probably a bigger conversion movement than what's going on with radical Islam. And, you know, by and large, that's not had the same kinds of negative political effects. In fact, you could say in many places it's had a more positive democratizing and modernizing one.
Francis Fukuyama is professor of international political economy at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C. We're going to take a couple of more questions with him after the break. And if you'd like to get in on the conversation, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email TOTN at npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're talking with the author of The End of History and Our Post-Human Future, Francis Fukuyama, about how how radical Islam may actually turn out to be a modernizing force in the Arab world. To get in on the conversation, our phone call is 800-989-8255, our email address, TOTN at npr.org, and an email question we have from Allison Reedy in Northampton, New Hampshire. I was wondering if your guest could comment on the situation in Nigeria, where Islamic law is on the rise. This ultra-conservative approach, while perhaps not considered radical, is certainly worrisome, especially from a human rights perspective. Does your guest see this type of governance subsiding in the future? I hope so, adds Allison.
I really can't say very much about Nigeria specifically, because it's just a country I don't know terribly much about. Certainly the rise of... you know, the strict application of Sharia law is related to the rise of Islamism, radical Islamism in the Arab world, and I think in a certain sense it's all part of a similar movement, although it gets interpreted, you know, very differently once you get outside the Arab world.
So the cultural context is extremely important.
Yes.
Okay. Let's go now to Chris, who's with us from Searcy, Arkansas.
Yes, Dr. Fukuyama, it appears that you believe that all civilizations are tending to evolve towards some sort of a liberal democracy. And I was wondering if that's really what you believe, that all civilizations, Islamic civilization, Asiatic civilization, are they destined for this? And if so, why?
Well, I don't think anyone's destined in the sense of, you know, this kind of Marxist determinism that that some people on the left used to believe in. But I do think that modernization is a coherent process. It begins with technological change. All countries that, you know, develop an industrial civilization are organized around cities and, you know, a certain kind of division of labor. And that is, I think, really what drives this process, that people want a higher standard of living. Therefore, they accept the conditions that are necessary to modernize economically. And then this brings about certain political changes. As you get richer, you tend to be more democratic. And this is a process that has taken place all over the world. It started in Europe and North America. It spread to parts of Asia, Latin America. And I don't think it's inevitable that this will happen everywhere, but people are voting with their feet in favor of living in modern societies. There's a huge one-way traffic of immigrants from less developed to more developed countries, indicating that there's something about that modern synthesis that is extremely desirable.
Okay, Chris?
Thank you.
Thanks very much. And we'll get one more call in for Professor Fukuyama. Shawish joins us from Minneapolis.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I like your program a lot.
Oh, thank you.
And I watch, I listen to it every day. But I don't agree with the professor for him saying that the radical Islam is... at first, I don't agree with the term of Islam is not a radical. Islam is the religious of God. Come to people.
He was very careful to draw a distinction between Islam and what he called radical Islamism, which he defined as a political movement that had little is distinct from the religion.
Correct. Yes. Yes. Yeah. I understand what you mean.
Yes.
But many people today using that term of radical Islam, and then they eventually they would say Islam is a radical or it's a radical religion.
Okay, well, we did define the terms earlier. Anyway, I wanted to get to your question.
My question is, I wish that if the West will leave the Muslim countries alone and have a respective relation, international relationship, than giving them pressure... giving their leaders pressure, because people now they're in Middle East and all of these countries against West because they think these leaders being supported from West, and they are the one who keeping them there.
Mm-hmm.
But Islam is talk about democracy and Shura and all of that, and Shura mean democracy in somehow, and Shura mean that you collect very intellectual people who understand Islam and people life, and then you collect them together and you ask them how people possess their future in both ways.
Okay.
Because Islam is it's a social utility and political utility and all of these things. So people or Muslims turn to try to carry out both lives, this life and the life after.
Okay, let's see if we get a response quickly.
Well, I agree that we need to think in American foreign policy, rethink the relationship with authoritarian regimes like the ones in Egypt and Saudi Arabia. But I think the reason that the United States and other Western countries are involved in this part of the world is not simply that, you know, it's not a one-way street. It's because there are disagreements, you know, within that region and conflicts that have drawn outsiders in. So it's a much more complicated situation, I think, than the caller suggests.
Okay, and let us go now to Serena, who's with us from Tarzana, California.
Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air.
I have two questions. First one is about the opinion of Mr. Fukuyama about this new movement of democratization in political Islam in Iran. And the second question is about his opinion about the role of American government in empowering the Islamic movement, the radical Islamic movement in the Middle East during the Cold War?
Well, there is, I think, a growing pro-democracy movement that's actually part of which is actually quite overtly pro-American in Iran. As I said earlier, I think that's a very positive development, and my prediction is that one of these days there's going to be a real liberalization of the regime there. In terms of America, I mean, I think there's no secret that the United States supported the Mujahideen during the war against the Soviets. I think that policy made sense then, but it was carried on too long, and then America lost interest, and so it bears some responsibility for the situation now. But you know, these matters are very complicated. And
okay,
Serena.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks very much for the call. As we move ahead, excuse me, I pushed the wrong button. As we move ahead, one of the things that you write about are the challenges to some of the things that need to be changed in the Islamic world if they're going to evolve into more modern democracies. And one of the more interesting questions that you raise was towards the jurisprudence system in the Islamic world and the challenges that are being mounted towards that. But the challenges, as you point out in your article, have been almost constant over the years.
Well, that's right. I think that the important changes that will take place in that part of the world will be political ones. I think that it will come in reaction. You know, I think the most important issue really is secular politics. That's the issue of principle that separates the radical Islamists from liberal versions of Islam, and that's what makes this doctrine, I think, really deeply opposed to one of the most basic principles. Not that we in the West are against religion, but we want to keep religion separate from politics. And that's just a fundamental principle. And as I said, it is a political decision to make that separation.
And not an easy one.
Not an easy one. It wasn't an easy one in Western civilization. It won't be an easy one in Muslim countries today. But that's the central issue that they have to face, whether they want secular government. Turkey long ago made that decision, and I think one of the reasons that it is one of the most democratic and developed countries in that region is precisely because it accepted that basic condition of a modern political order. And that's a decision I think that Iran is likely to make, in the near term, and will confront other states in that region.
Interesting times. Thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you very much.
Francis Fukuyama was with us here in Studio 3A. He is author, among other things, of an article published this past fall in Commentary magazine called Creative Destruction: Can Any Good Come of Radical Islam? And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.